and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the corruption scandal in Israel that has ensnared Prime Minister Netanyahu, who Israeli police say there is enough evidence against in two corruption cases to recommend his indictment. Robert Malley, the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, who was the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa in the Obama administration, joins us to discuss whether Netanyahu will weather the storm of scandal and end up being Israel's longest-serving prime minister. We'll also look into the possibility of an uprising in Gaza as Israel turns the screws, punishing its beleaguered inhabitants who are the victims of an intra-Palestinian power struggle caught between the fanaticism of Hamas and the corruption of Fatah. We will explore the suggestion by Secretary of State Tillerson that the Trump administration has a plan in the works that won't be so lopsided as their lavishly pro-Israel stance so far would suggest, and that the U.S. might demand some concessions from Israel in a deal with the Palestinians in exchange for moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Then we will examine the resignation of South Africa's President Jacob Zuma, who stepped down today after 8 years in power, the last years of which found him mired in a series of corruption scandals that finally cost him the support of his ruling African National Congress Party. Catherine Newman, Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs of the University of Massachusetts System, and author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa, joins us to assess what might follow Zuma's spectacular fall from grace. Then finally, with Donald Trump reversing his populist election campaign message of draining the Wall Street swamp and making hedge fund billionaires pay the same tax rate as their secretaries do, we will speak with Sheila Kolhatkar, the author of Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. Now that Trump is surrounded by former Goldman Sachs executives and is giving away the store to Wall Street, we will follow the tale of insider trading and the downfall of a disgraced hedge fund titan who is now back in business. And joining us now is Robert Malley, who's the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent conflicts worldwide. He previously was a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, the President Clinton's national security advisor and director for democracy, human rights, and humanitarian affairs on the National Security Council. And he served in the Obama administration as White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Malley.
Thanks for having me.
And Prime Minister Netanyahu is on his way to becoming Israel's longest-serving prime minister, appears to be in some trouble with the law. There is an expectation he may be able to weather the storm, but there's certainly a lot of demonstrations, etc., against him. But he's in a pretty powerful position, and he's always been underestimated, I guess, and seems to have survived. I think it was you that told me on the first meeting that President Bill Clinton had with Netanyahu, after Netanyahu left the Oval Office, Clinton was so rattled and he turned to his staff and said, "Who is the effing superpower around here?" Is that an apocryphal story?
It's an accurate story that a number of my colleagues and I have recounted over the years. You're right that he has been underestimated, and you're right that nobody should count him out. There's a lot that's accumulating against him, on the other hand, and it's not just the legal cases, and there's more than one. And the Attorney General may well recommend an indictment. But there's also a fatigue, and there's also within his own party some impatience and some eagerness to make way for the next generation, fearing that the corruption scandals that are enveloping him could drag down his party, the Likud, with him. As you say, I think nobody should count him out. He has a number of ways that he's going to try to use to survive yet again.
Well, it may be a surprise to our listeners, but the Likud party that he's the head of is a part of a six-party right-wing coalition, and it's basically in that spectrum. It's pretty much center-right, isn't it, compared to the other parties. So he is a sort of, you know, almost a liberal anchor in a right-wing party. Is that the way to look at it?
That's probably overstating it just slightly. listen, I mean, the Likud's platform today doesn't accept a two-state solution. the majority of the Israeli cabinet today rejects a two-state solution. So, you know, shades of right-wing among all of them, some more than others. I think Benjamin Netanyahu himself is in a odd position because in the past he has said publicly that he accepts a two-state solution. He gave a famous speech in which he laid that out. He has told American officials over the years that there are some compromises that he would accept that go against what his party's platform and has officially endorsed. So I think the real question beyond the legal fate of these cases that are being brought against the prime minister is the fact that we just heard today from Secretary of State Tillerson that the United States, we knew that they were preparing some kind of plan. He says that they are close to being done, that it's going to be a plan that's going to cover all the issues and that it's going to be more fair, certainly, than I think people might expect. You know, let's see what comes up. But I think it's going to be interesting if, in fact, the U.S. puts a plan on the table that has elements that go against the wishes of the Likud party. How does the prime minister position himself? Does he try to say, I'm with the Americans and go to elections on that platform? Or does he oppose a plan if, in fact, it crosses his party's red line?
But I don't think there's been a more pro-Israel administration than the Trump administration, with Jared Kushner, who gave up his bedroom to Netanyahu, who was a regular visitor, family friend, Trump's lawyer, who's quite passionately pro-Israel.
Who has funded settlements.
Right, exactly. I mean, so, and of course, the extraordinary shift in U.S. foreign policy in terms of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, making the U.S. the only country in the world to take that step, that's an extraordinary step in its own. So how would you rate it, since you've obviously been involved in this for some time?
There is no doubt that the administration so far has done everything to burnish its pro-Israeli credentials, and you've mentioned a number of the pieces of evidence about it, also cutting funding for the U.N. agency that helped Palestinian refugees, and speaking about the Palestinian leader, President Abbas, in ways that are quite negative. So you put all that together, plus the identity of the people who are in charge of the peace process, and a logical conclusion would be not only is it the most pro-Israeli, but it's one that's going to continue to tilt in that direction, both because of the conviction of the people who are leading the charge, but also for domestic political considerations. Weighing against that, and I'm not saying that it's weighing in a very heavy way, but weighing against it is the professed desire by President Trump, which he keeps repeating, that he's going to make the deal of the century, that it's going to be something that both sides are going to have to take seriously. Listen, right until we see it and until we study it, it's going to be very hard for me to believe it. But it is what administration officials say publicly and privately, that their plan is going to surprise the observers by how fair it is. I have my doubts. I'm not sure that their definition of fair is anywhere near mine, let alone the Palestinians or the Arabs or most neutral observers. But, you know, let's wait and see. If he really wants to get a deal, he's not going to be able to continue on this path. He's going to have to say, as he said already, I gave Israel something important with Jerusalem. Now they're going to have to give something important in terms of the concessions they're prepared to make to reach a deal. I wouldn't hold my breath, but according to Secretary Tillerson, we'll soon find out.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Malley, who's the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent conflicts worldwide. He was previously a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, President Clinton's national security advisor, and was director for democracy, human rights, and humanitarian affairs for the National Security Council. And he served in the Obama White House as the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. Well, but in terms of the Israeli right and Netanyahu, the leader of the Israeli right, they've never really had an end game, at least one that they want to announce. And now they're really turning the screws on Gaza in conjunction with Sisi of Egypt. Of course, Hamas is a sort of protege of the Muslim Brotherhood, and there's a lot of military activity now in the Sinai, which in fact there's joint Egyptian and Israeli airstrikes. So what do you think the agenda is here? Because you wonder at what point will the Palestinians continue to take punishment there? It seems as though at a certain point, particularly in Gaza, where they're really starving, there may be an explosion.
So I think there's two questions. One, the agenda of the Likud when it comes to the West Bank, there's a divergence, I think, among some, but some of their members want to annex the West Bank and or certainly annex the settlements in the West Bank. And there's a bill that Prime Minister Netanyahu tried to slow down, has slowed down the consideration of, which would have led to annexation. So there's a divergence of view, although it goes from, as I say, right-wing to hard-right. Gaza is a separate issue, and you forgot, I think, two culprits in your list of protagonists who are responsible for the absolute misery of Gaza, and I was there a few years ago, and it is exactly as you describe it. And that's Hamas and Fatah, the two principal Palestinian parties who are making Gaza the victim of their feud for power, their tug of war. And they have not yet reached agreement on how to reconcile, on how to govern Gaza, and therefore Gaza is the victim, as I say, of a collective conspiracy, Israel, Hamas, Fatah, Egypt. Unfortunately, each one of them trying to defend interests that have nothing to do with those of the civilians on the ground who are pawns in this battle. And it is a scandal, but as I say, it's a scandal for which responsibility, unfortunately, is shared by many, not just Israel, but also the Palestinians and also Egypt.
So is there an alternative to these kind of, you've got kind of religious fascists with Hamas, the very word means zeal, and then you've got this corrupt Fatah. Is there a possibility of any political movement that would actually represent the Palestinians emerging?
So I'm not sure I would completely endorse your description of both, but putting that aside, there's no third party. I think it's an illusion to expect a third party to emerge, but there needs to be is pressure from the base, from the ground up, on Hamas and Fatah to put some of their differences aside. They will not unify as one party, but put some of their differences aside for the sake of governance, normal governance in Gaza, and for the sake of agreeing on a political platform which they could then put forward to the international community and to Israel about what their objectives are and how they intend to pursue them. There have been efforts in the past which were trying to say that both should agree on a creation of a Palestinian state by means of nonviolent resistance, but unfortunately they haven't been able to come together on that platform or in terms of how they're going to share power in Gaza or agree on new elections. I mean, there haven't been elections in over a decade, and that is obviously not just corrosive in terms of the ability to regenerate the democratic life among Palestinians, but it means that you now have a national movement that is no longer in tune with or representative of the people on whose behalf it's supposed to be fighting.
Well, that became apparent when the Palestinian papers were leaked, and there was a great sort of resurgence amongst the young Palestinians of basically the evidence of, you know, a stalemate and incompetence from this aging leadership. So that's why I asked that question. But in terms of...
there is going to have to be a rejuvenation of the Palestinian leadership, and there's several elements that are going to have to take place. There's going to have to be some reckoning between Fatah and Hamas. They're going to have to agree on some platform so that they could go to elections and avoid the civil war, which they experienced in the past. There's going to be some transformation in Fatah. I mean, President Abbas is not young. At some point, he will no longer be president, and they're going to have to pass the reins to the next generation. And finally, there's going to have to be a reckoning of the Palestinian national movement as a whole, Hamas, Fatah, and beyond, again, to try to figure out what it is that they're pursuing, on what basis, and with what means. And they face a huge challenge because the international and regional environment today is about as hostile to the Palestinians as it's been in decades.
And that's what makes one wonder. The kind of screws are turning, and it's getting tougher and tougher. And, I mean, if there is some breakthrough here from the U.S. side, which would be a big surprise, as you pointed out, what's your sense of how it's going to play in Israel? Are they really interested anymore in a two-state solution, given that
first of all, you did mention the risk of an explosion in Gaza, and you're absolutely right. The worse the conditions get there, the more likely there's going to be renewed warfare between Hamas and Israel, and I think that's something we really need to watch. There's already been too many wars there, and there could be one more. Your question about the two-state solution, it's a very good one. I mean, I think there's more energy, more support for the two-state solution around the world than there is among the people concerned. I mean, I just came back last month from a trip to Israel and the West Bank. It's very hard to find a Palestinian under the age of 30 who still believes in, cares for, has any faith in a two-state solution. They've moved on. They see what's happening on the ground. they see that the negotiations have led nowhere. They don't trust their own leadership. They don't trust the U.S. as a mediator of the process. So they're on to other things. Some of them given up on politics. Others believe in a one-state solution. Others believe in civil disobedience. So you have a debate, but you don't have a direction, and you certainly don't have sympathy for or embrace of a two-state solution. The same among many in Israel as well. They've moved on because, you know, we've been talking about this since 1993. We were supposed to be over with it in 1999. We're now in 2018, and if anything, the boat has moved much further from a two-state solution in terms of public attitudes, in terms of the realities on the ground, settlement construction, home demolition. So it's very hard today to try to convince people who are not already converted that this is a fight worth fighting for, because they just don't see it happening. And that's why, you know, who knows what will happen with the Trump administration. Anyone who seeks to predict it is on a fool's errand. But we could well be living some of the last gasps of this era of the two-state solution, and then we're going to be in uncharted territory.
Back to Prime Minister Netanyahu's legal problems with the police recommending indicting him on two corruption cases. He's received $280,000 in gifts, largely from a movie producer, Arnon Milchan, and an Australian billionaire. And the other case, of course, involves the main popular daily newspaper that was under competition from the free newspaper from Sheldon Adelson. Apparently, that he was caught on tape. One of his aides actually taped him in a conversation, Netanyahu basically asking the editor of the newspaper to give him favorable coverage and somehow restrain Adelson. So is there a real case there, do you think?
I can't speculate. Obviously, I haven't seen the evidence. I know that it's been mounting, and there's a case where there's smoke, there probably is fire, but I'm not about to pronounce myself on the legalities of what happened. We'll have to let it play out. As I said at the beginning, I think the Prime Minister has different ways he's going to try to use, and those who are following U.S. politics will find it familiar, different ways to try to delegitimize the case against him and live to fight another day.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Malley.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Malley, who's the President and CEO of the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent conflicts worldwide. He was previously a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, President Clinton's National Security Advisor and Director for Democracy, Human Rights, and Humanitarian Affairs for the National Security Council. And in the Obama administration, he served as the White House Coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's reversal of his election campaign of draining the Wall Street swamp and making hedge fund billionaires pay the same tax rate as their secretaries do. מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Newman, who's the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at the University of Massachusetts System. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family and The Missing Class. And she's also the author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Newman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Catherine. And today, Jacob Zuma announced his resignation on national television in an address to the nation. He's been beleaguered for some time. His 8-year term, the last few years, have been dogged by scandal. And, of course, he's going to be replaced by the deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who is the ANC's new leader. So the ANC basically asked him to step down. Do you think, I mean, let's start with the positive news. Everybody seems to speak highly of Cyril Ramaphosa. So will he be a breath of fresh air?
I think Cyril Ramaphosa will be a breath of fresh air compared to Jacob Zuma. But that's not a difficult bar to reach. Zuma was widely discredited as corrupt, as inept, and as largely being out for himself, his family, and his friends. So he was so horrendously discredited that I don't think it would be difficult for anybody following after him to do a better job. Ramaphosa is regarded as a reformer. But he's also an extremely wealthy businessman who has lived a very high life in a country plagued by inequality and poverty. So while I think there is tremendous rejoicing in South Africa today, people will be watching to see where Ramaphosa's policies land him, given that his own personal wealth has been quite outsized in a country that has struggled with high levels of poverty.
Just yesterday, in fact, police raided the Johannesburg home of the powerful and wealthy Gupta family, with whom Zuma has close ties and has apparently been basically carrying their water and doing their bidding. What's going on there? Is there going to be some kind of a trial, do you think?
Well, that's possible. I think what was going on there was a signal to other friends of Zuma's that it's dangerous to be a friend of Zuma's, and that the police had changed sides in their allegiances, and that this was going to be the party sort of saber-rattling at Zuma's network. And I think that's one of the reasons why he did finally step down. I just think his supporters probably began to desert him as the cost to them began to get ever more uncomfortable, which is certainly the situation the Guptas are in. As to whether or not the ANC will try to move past this and forget about these corrupt ways and try to move forward, or pursue that kind of truth and reconciliation approach they were known for in the post-apartheid period, I really don't know. I haven't read any speculations on that score. My guess is that everyone's ready to turn this page. They've been ready to do so for a long, long time now.
Well, I wonder, though, back in October of 2017, the Supreme Court of Appeals ruled that Zuma must face 18 counts of corruption, fraud, racketeering, and money laundering charges. So that's a pretty hefty docket to make disappear.
It is, and it may be that Zuma himself will have to face the music. I don't know whether they will spend a lot of time going after his network. I just have no idea. But yeah, this is a pretty serious load of corruption charges. I don't think that by itself would have brought Zuma down, because he has been engaged in corruption and self-dealing for almost his entire time as president. There are several things that I think changed in recent years and recent months in particular. The devaluing of the South African currency, the flight of capital out of South Africa, the continued flight of people of means out of South Africa, I think started to cost the country a lot and became more and more serious. The sort of problems in Cape Town right now of disappearing water supplies, although that's not anybody's fault per se, you've got a real catastrophe building in one of the most important cities in South Africa. And it's not really clear exactly what the government's doing to make a difference. But it's going to be the first major city in the world to run out of water completely. And that's a new experience for everyone living there, as well as the rest of us watching from around the world. So I think there have been a series of financial catastrophes and climatic controversies on top of this long legacy of corruption that people have just had enough of.
And again, I'm speaking with Catherine Newman, who's a Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs of the University of Massachusetts System. She's the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality. And her latest book is After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. I have to add, by the way, that Zuma actually is facing 783 counts of corruption. So I guess they've been piling up, right?
It is a big list. It's true.
And we know, and you mentioned, of course, the fact that the major cities on the southern tip of the continent, Cape Town, is been suffering from no water. They did have some rain recently, but global warming appears to be the culprit there, and that's not going to go away. So that's a major problem to be handled just on its own. But the bar, of course, was raised pretty high by Mandela. But the point is, I guess, that as you alluded to earlier, Catherine, that the real issue with South Africa is economic inequality. It hasn't changed. If anything, it's gotten worse. You mentioned Cyril Ramaphosa is a wealthy businessman, and Zuma was in cahoots with the wealthy Gupta brothers. So that's clearly a festering problem. And I guess the left wing of the ANC and the youth wing are pretty frustrated, aren't they, about economic inequality?
They are very frustrated about this. I do think that the ire was focused mostly on corruption. It's true that the youth wing focuses on land distribution and inequality more generally, but I think from a popular point of view, the real frustration has been with corruption and the failure to deliver the most basic services. You know, we still have just millions of people who are not only living in poverty, but living without water, which is why, ironically, folks in the townships are, you know, often heard to say that now Cape Town's wealthier population will learn something about what it's like to live without water, since they've been living without water for decades. But you've got, you know, problems of delivering electricity, problems in the school systems, all of the festering issues that are, you know, failure to deliver services, which often lead to strikes in the streets. The most proximate, shall we say, experience of inequality comes through these deprivations. And I do think that in the face of those manifestations of inequality, the profligate living of people like Zuma just stand out as incredible frustrations for everybody, which is why you saw the loss of ANC support in almost all the major cities and the rise of the Democratic Alliance and other parties that, you know, is sort of like anybody but the ANC. And so I think ANC leaders came to realize if they didn't get rid of this man, they were going to see their party sink without a trace. So this is a rallying point for the ANC and a chance for it to rebuild some level of confidence in the voting public, which is right now quite low.
Well, it's clear that Zuma really didn't have much choice, and he took the easy way out because he was facing impeachment or a vote of no confidence. But in his address to the nation, he said that no life should be lost in my name, and also the ANC should never be divided in my name. I have therefore come to the decision to resign as President of the Republic with immediate effect. Even though I disagree with the decision of the leadership of my organization, I've always been a disciplined member of the ANC. As I leave, I will continue to serve the people of South Africa as well as the ANC, the organization that I have served all my life. Well, he served himself as well, I guess, but
he did, and quite honestly, you know, this this sort of retrospective of his that he's always been a disciplined member of the ANC is ridiculous. The ANC has been trying to get him out for years now, and he's been willing to tolerate tremendous internal dissension and the loss, as I said before, of the political support needed to govern from all the major cities in South Africa. So I think we have to take what he has to say about his own recent history with a huge grain of salt. The real question now is whether Ramaphosa represents a new leaf. He has been, you know, sort of closely associated with Zuma up until fairly recently, and he has not exactly been a loud voice calling Zuma to account for his ethical lapses. His conversion to reform is of fairly recent vintage. Nonetheless, you know, I think everybody in South Africa wants to move away from Zuma's legacy because it's not a very positive one. And it has cost that country internally. It's cost it economically on the world stage. And, you know, almost everyone is the poorer for it.
But when he talks about that he doesn't want any violence to take place in his name, no life should be lost in my name, is the exact quote. There have been some battles, right, within various factions of the ANC. Is that what that's what he's referring to?
There have been political battles, and there have been sort of episodes of street violence, not clearly associated with Zuma. We did not see, for example, some of the tactics that would have been very familiar in Zimbabwe. It has not gotten to be that bad. You know, democratic institutions still matter in South Africa, even though corruption is a problem. I do think it's important to point out that democracy is alive and well in South Africa. That doesn't mean there's never any taint of corruption. It just means people can be called to account, however slowly and with you know, episodic success that may occur. But you have a judiciary that's still functioning. You have an opposition parties that are still functioning, and that's not something that's not a trivial accomplishment in Africa, especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, of course, Zuma's predecessor, Thabo Mbeki, he was forced out as president by the ANC back in 2008. My sense is that the real issue here is that, given the appalling examples of corrupt and despotic and psychotic, in some cases, leadership, like South Sudan, the newest country in the world, these two horrible warlords are just tearing the country apart over a personal feud. Millions are dying. So there's been some awful examples across the continent of appalling misrule. And by contrast, South Africa has always been a kind of beacon of stability and democracy. And, of course, had the ruling nationalists, the Boers, not been so boneheaded, they could have turned South Africa into a sort of multiracial superpower. As an example for the nation, it's playing catch-up, obviously, in the post-apartheid era. But the economic divisions are so vast and growing that does kind of undercut that image, does it not, of this being the kind of model for what the continent could be?
I think that's right. Now, you know, to be fair, if we look at the level of poverty that existed when Mandela took the presidency, we have to credit just how incredibly poor and devastated the country was, how far it had to go, and what the ANC was able to do in the way of providing basic services, housing, schooling, to a country where the vast majority was left with very little in the way of educational opportunity. So while I'm, you know, I think like every observer of South Africa, critical of all that remains to be done and of the squandering that took place under Zuma's rule, I do think we have to credit how far the country has come as well. I mean, it may not be a glass half full, but it's not completely empty either. And I just think we often underestimate how devastatingly poor and vastly unequal the country was at the time it transitioned to democracy. So I just want to leaven the conversation with a recognition of the extraordinary difficulty of shedding the burdens that South Africa came into democracy with. That doesn't mean it doesn't have a very, very long way to go. It does.
Well, I think the measure of success has been seen in terms of the development of a black middle class. And that applies to countries like China, too. That seems to be the way that we measure countries that have evolved into sort of, some kind of successful economic model. How would you rate the black middle class? I mean, there has been a kind of black middle class. I mean, obviously, Zuma and Ramaphosa are the upper class in terms of their wealth, but How would you describe the black middle class that's come about?
There has been a very dramatic growth in the size of the black middle class. Remembering that it started at zero, it's been quite dramatic. And when I wrote After Freedom, part of the purpose of the book was to look at people who were in the middle class, you know, black, white, and what they call colored populations in the middle class, to compare them to the people who were at the bottom of the class structure, because class really matters in South Africa, not just skin color. The growth of the black middle class has been enormous. But I think in many ways it was the black middle class that was the most disillusioned with Zuma, because it's the black middle class that was looking at what the possibilities might be if South Africa had been truly able to turn a corner toward the more sort of stable, well-managed economies that they hunger to become. And the fact that this was squandered, these opportunities were squandered, were extremely distressing, especially to upwardly mobile young people who are looking for signs of a stable government, of rational decision making, of fairness and opportunity, and the possibilities of their brothers and sisters in the townships moving up the ladder as well, which was highly compromised by this continued rampant inequality.
Well, Catherine, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Newman, who's a Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs of the University of Massachusetts System. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality. And she's the author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the resignation of South Africa's President Jacob Zuma. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sheila Kolhatka, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Previously, she was a features editor and national correspondent at Bloomberg Businessweek. And her work has also appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The New York Times Review of Books, and Time Magazine, among other publications. She appears as a speaker and commentator on business economics, Wall Street regulation, financial crime, politics, Silicon Valley, income inequality, and women's issues. And she worked on Wall Street for several years as a risk arbitrage analyst at two hedge funds in New York City. And she's the author of the new book just out, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Kolhatka.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And the subject of your book is making something of a comeback. There was a kind of Valentine to him, and now that it's Valentine's Day, I read the other day. And, of course, I guess the ultimate Valentine to all hedge fund billionaires is that the man who said he was going to drain the swamp and get rid of carried interest, President Donald Trump, has more or less done the opposite. And, you know, he ran, after all, against Hillary Clinton, painted her as a creature of Wall Street, but it looks like a real creature of Wall Street might end up as his chief of staff. So what's going on here?
Well, there's obviously a bit of irony here because, of course, one of the biggest campaign lines that was used against Secretary Clinton when she ran was that she had given paid speeches at Goldman Sachs, and people really hammered her over this. And Donald Trump painted himself as this populist hero who's going to champion the interests of middle-class Americans, people in small factory towns around the country. And of course, once he became president, he's really shocked people, even those in the financial sector, with just how generous he has been to them. And in fact, he was no favored figure on Wall Street before, and certain many banks wouldn't even do business with him. I don't think he was necessarily a well-respected business figure, but he has gone out of his way to bestow policy gifts on the investor class, people who own shares, people who trade or manage money for a living, employees of big banks. And it has shocked even the people in those industries, just how generous Trump has been to them.
So is there a psychological component here? Because the guy from Queens has always wanted to make it in Manhattan and kind of be accepted amongst the titans of Wall Street and in New York City. Is this some way to curry favor with, or become acknowledged? I mean, let's face it, being president of the United States is a pretty powerful Trump card, isn't it?
Yes, I think at this point he can stop feeling insecure about himself.
We should let him know that, because he doesn't act that way. He is an insecure narcissist. It's a very strange paradox, isn't it?
I know, and it obviously drives a lot of his decisions. Well, so that storyline of sort of a kid from the outer boroughs wanting to come and make it in Manhattan, and that's a very powerful storyline. In fact, that was a real driving force in the life of Steve Cohen, who is the subject of my book, the hedge fund billionaire, who's now coming back into the market. You know, Trump was a little different. He was born to a very wealthy, successful father, as we know. And I think what's going on now is just, it has a lot more to do with the donor class in Washington, the kinds of people who are whispering in his ear and who are advising the people Trump has surrounded himself with. And you know, we did see this kind of scramble after he was elected as he tried to figure out who to install in different key policy roles. And, of course, we've ended up with hedge fund managers and billionaire investors, corporate raiders, Wall Street investment bankers occupying all sorts of key roles, from Treasury Secretary to key economic advisory roles. And I think a lot of that had to do with who Trump happened to listen to at the moment he had to staff those jobs. And once those people were in there, those are the people who are telling him what to do. And as some of my colleagues at The New Yorker have reported, you know, people like the Koch brothers, big-time Republican donors, are exerting a lot of influence on Trump's White House through different mechanisms. And I think all of those things play into his policy positions, which, again, do not really help the people he promised he would help when he was campaigning.
And again, I'm speaking with Sheila Kolhatkar, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Previously, she was a features editor and national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, New York, and Time magazine. And she spent several years as a risk arbitrage analyst at two hedge funds in New York City, and she's the author of the new book just out, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. So let's talk about the subject of your book, Stephen A. Cohen and the huge hedge fund, $15 billion hedge fund that he, or $13 billion, I guess, that he headed up, and the fact that he's now allowed back into the market after, I guess, what amounts to a slap on the wrist is pretty extraordinary. But in general, could you make the case that Wall Street, you know, in the days of the robber barons, that at least they produced things, Carnegie and Company, they steel and Rockefellers, oil. I mean, these were tangible goods. It seems to me that so much of what Wall Street is about today and what these hedge funds are about is making money out of money. And I wonder whether in the long term, it's a sustainable economic model to keep extracting wealth as opposed to creating wealth.
Well, it's true that the capital market system exists to help fuel economic growth by channeling capital, money that people have to invest, the savings of American citizens, and channeling that money to productive use, to real businesses, to companies that want to take out loans so they can expand, companies that are going public. And of course, a lot of Wall Street activity has moved away from that real kind of capital growth activity into this financial speculation realm, of which Stephen Cohen was sort of one of the most successful people. And that involves essentially making bets in the market on the movements of securities prices based on different events. And of course, yes, a lot of people argue that hedge funds in particular don't add any value to the economy. Now, the hedge funds, if you present that criticism to them, they say, well, we add liquidity to the market. You know, we help drive stock prices to their true value by doing all this research and trading in them every day. And they also like to point out that they do manage investment money of, you know, retirees and pension funds. And there's truth to that, of course. However, it's true that they're not really, you know, relative to the amount of money that many of them make, certainly the very successful ones, they employ relatively few people. They pay lower taxes in large part than working people who are paying income tax. And, you know, they cause a lot of harm. So there is a real debate about whether the incentives in the system are kind of driving people towards that sort of activity. And the really helpful economic activity they could be engaged in is much less attractive. It doesn't involve the same kind of short-term profit potential that they have come to want. So I think that is a valid concern, whether or not the game is going to kind of run out anytime soon. I mean, that's a good question. There will inevitably be some kind of financial crisis at some point. Many hedge funds have borrowed a lot of money. And yes, at some point it may become a much more difficult way to make money. But as it stands right now, people are still flocking into jobs at these firms out of the best colleges, you know, sort of brain drain, so to speak, because you can still make a lot of money very quickly if things go well for you.
Well, Renaissance Capital, of course, has an extraordinary track record. How could you make all that money? And, of course, the hedge fund managers get a big cut. I mean, is there a finite number of investments that have those kind of extraordinary returns?
Well, there is a finite number, and in fact, what's happened is that it's gotten much, much harder to make money that way. And you know, when Mr. Cohen started his fund, for example, in 1992, there were relatively few hedge funds, so you kind of had the field to yourself, and it was really easy pickings. You could kind of go out there, you know, root around in some corner of the investing world that was overlooked by other people. If you were really clever, you could come up with a way to make money, which he certainly did. But eventually, other people started to pile in and want to copy this successful strategy. So now, by one estimate, there are $3 trillion in assets being managed by hedge funds around the world. And for the most part, if you look at them on average, they are not doing that well. Most of them do not justify the very large fees that they charge. You have a lot of sort of pension funds and endowment funds reevaluating all the fees they've paid to hedge fund managers because they're not really getting returns in exchange for that. So yes, what happens is you have a handful, tiny fraction of super successful funds, and everyone else is either doing very, very mediocre or very poorly, and you have a lot of funds closing. But there is still this sort of desperation among many pension fund managers to find returns. They have to pay for their employee, you know, their retiree health care coverage every year. The market, although it's done well, it's unpredictable. So there's still this sort of desperation to sort of find reliable returns. And the successful hedge funds will probably continue to do really well, even though the environment overall has become really difficult.
Well, the irony is, of course, that the subject of your book, Black Edge, Stephen A. Cohen of SAC Capital Advisors, he is kind of a powerful symbol of Wall Street's resurgence under President Trump, as you wrote in a recent piece in the New York Times, When Wall Street Writes Its Own Rules. And you have to add to that Mick Mulvaney taking over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was the sort of brainchild of Elizabeth Warren, and the most, I think, effective part of that new bureau under Cordray, the most effective part of the Dodd-Frank rule, which of course continues to get watered down. No question, Mulvaney is basically another case of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. But then, of course, the other part of your story is Preet Bharara, the prosecutor. And he was one of the first casualties of Trump. I mean, Trump wanted to hire him, or at least he said he did. I guess it's a bit like Mitt Romney, right? I want you to be Secretary of State. then he gives him the back of the hand. So is there a kind of systematic takedown here of the watchdogs?
Well, I can't help but see a real pattern when I look at all of these things together. Now, we know Trump really wants to deregulate and remove federal rules and laws and regulations governing business. He's been doing that. And in fact, I think that's been one of the biggest accomplishments of his administration. While there's a lot of hysteria and people following, the Russia investigation and various day-to-day scandals at the White House, of which there are many, behind the scenes, the thing that has been progressing quite smoothly has been this deregulation. And Wall Street is the perhaps the top beneficiary of that. And I thought the firing of Preet Bharara was sort of interesting. Now, it's common for new presidents to replace U.S. attorneys. But Preet had particularly made his name as an enforcer of Wall Street. Now, there's controversy around his priorities, and some people feel he should have brought different cases than the ones he did. But I thought it was interesting to look at him as a form of regulation on the market. I mean, if you have someone like him in a powerful role at the New York U.S. Attorney's Office, that has a regulatory sort of enforcement impact on the stock market. People have to worry about being prosecuted for securities crimes. When you get rid of someone like that, and put in someone who's much less focused on Wall Street transgressions, you end up in a sort of a deregulatory environment where people do not have to worry about being prosecuted. And when you look at that, combined with the CFPB, as you mentioned, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, what's going on at other regulatory agencies, tax policies Trump has signed into law that largely benefit wealthy investors over middle-class taxpayers, you know, it does create this real picture that he's really trying to help out this group of people who don't really need the help. And one of the big tools for that is deregulation, for sure.
So are there any parallels here? Because your story is a thriller, and I mean a real-life thriller, Black Edge. In terms of those that flipped, like Matthew Matoma, and turned against Cohen and testified against him. Is there any sort of parallels there to, say, the Mueller investigation?
That's an interesting question. Well, it's true that, prosecutors, when they tried to build a case against Cohen, which to be honest, they never really succeeded in doing ultimately, they indicted his company. They didn't charge him personally with anything. But, yeah, they tried to use very classic sort of law enforcement techniques, the way you might pursue members of a crime family by starting with lower level employees and pressuring them to flip and turn on their bosses and then the bosses' bosses, and they had hoped to work their way up. Now, obviously Mueller is following a similar playbook. I mean, what you do is you go to the lower hanging fruit, the people who've clearly committed crimes, who are sloppy, where you have powerful evidence that's going to motivate those people to cooperate, and you pressure them to turn. Now, what happened in the Cohen case ultimately is they reached a point where no one would flip anymore, and that was sort of the inner wall of loyalty of people Cohen had around him, people who had made a lot of money working for him, who were still friends with him. They just, at some point refused to cooperate with the FBI, and that's where the case pretty much ended. And they ended up indicting SAC Capital, Cohen's firm, instead of the individual. And the firm was fined almost $2 billion, which Mr. Cohen had to pay for the most part since he owns the company. But it really had no effect on him. So, of course, in Bob Mueller's case, we have to see where this strategy leads. But it can be a very successful investigatory strategy that has been used in mob cases and vast drug network cases, terrorism cases, and we'll have to see where it takes us in terms of the president.
Well, back to the big picture, though. You know, we know that getting rid of Glass-Steagall removed a... It was all done in the name of competition and boosting the economy, the same arguments that Trump is making for the deregulation that he's engaged in. And the results were pretty clear at the time. Very few people opposed what Bill Clinton did, least of all the chairman of the Fed, who, of course, when the 2008 crash happened, he was absolutely blindsided. He couldn't believe it was happening. So, you know, irrational exuberance has a life of its own, it would seem. So are we heading in this direction again, do you think? I don't know whether what's happening with the stock market now is a harbinger of worse things to come. But what was your reading? And what is there a moral to this tale, Black Edge?
Well, I think the first lesson you can draw out of it is that people are very short. The people's memories are very short-lived. And I continue to be surprised by how quickly people forget the lessons of only a few years ago. So if you look back at the 2008 financial crisis, that wrought mass economic devastation that arguably we're still trying to dig our way out of. I think it set the economic forces in play that led a lot of people to vote for the Trump candidacy. So we're going to be paying for that crisis for years and years in all sorts of ways. But already people have forgotten what happens when, yes, you remove all the rules. There's an enormous greed incentive at play in this industry. You cannot simply let the financial sector regulate itself. It's been proven over and over again that it cannot regulate itself. It needs sophisticated, intelligent regulation and enforcement. And every time that's been rolled back in the past, it has eventually led to a blow up of some kind. So that is sure to happen again. Who knows when it will be? I think the market swings of the last couple of weeks were sort of interesting because they kind of reminded everybody that you can't really be complacent about this, because when the market goes up all the time, it's very easy to think that it will never change and everyone feels sort of wealthy and happy. But of course, what goes up often comes down, and a lot of people feel there's an enormous bubble in the market. So yes, is this a good moment to deregulate the financial sector? I would argue that it's not, but we'll see. I don't think Trump agrees, unfortunately.
Well, Sheila Kolhatkar, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sheila Kolhatkar, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she's also a features editor and national correspondent. She was also a features editor and national correspondent at Bloomberg Business Week, and also her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, New York Time, and other publications. And she spent several years as a risk arbitrage analyst at two hedge funds on Wall Street, and is the author of the new book just out, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and a Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.